seated. Call the next case, please.
Department of Administration, Contessa et al., Honeywell International, Inc., Roger C. Greer, and John C. Dale, three halves.
May it please the Court, Madam Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Virginia, I'm Roger Krieger, and I represent the administrators in these actions arising out of the wrongful deaths of Joseph Grana III and Joseph Grana Sr. in a crash that occurred 2.5 minutes after their airplane took off from Chesterfield County Airport. We seek a new trial because the trial court erred in allowing prejudicial closing arguments that clearly violated the law, erred in refusing to grant an important correct jury instruction on proximate cause, erred in allowing hearsay on key issues to be read, displayed to the jury, and admitted as an exhibit, and erred in allowing other inadmissible testimony. I'm going to turn to the individual assignments of error in a moment, but first I'd like to say Honeywell, as a general matter, asked this court to believe that the trial court's errors were harmless because, according to Honeywell, there was, quote, no proof of the administrator's claims. That's from page 2 of their brief. But our opening brief summarized extensive proof of our claims, and they have disputed none of our summary in their brief. Furthermore, Honeywell has, as a matter of law, conceded that there was entirely sufficient evidence to prove our case. The trial court overruled Honeywell's motion to strike the evidence, and Honeywell has not challenged that ruling on appeal. Therefore, the law of this case is that the evidence was entirely sufficient to prove each and every element of our case, and to prove that this crash occurred because Honeywell designed its product so that it had a hole above the gears that controlled the pitch and flight of this airplane. And that hole allowed tiny particles of metal debris to fall down to, onto, and jam the flight control gears, rendering the plane uncontrollable and causing it to go nose down and crash. And the trial court itself never viewed the challenged rulings as harmless and inconsequential. At the post-trial hearing, Honeywell's counsel argued harmless error extensively, but the trial court accepted none of those arguments as an alternative ground of its denial of our post-trial motions. Turning to the individual assignments of error, I'm going to start with assignment 2 and then go to 1, 3, 5, and 4 in that order. Assignment of error 2 involves Honeywell's improper closing arguments. Those arguments violated Goins, Wood, and other long-established law of this court. And importantly, in this case, Honeywell cannot make any argument that that law did not apply to this case and should not be applied, because the trial court ruled pre-trial that there would be no evidence or argument regarding a lack of previous incidents, an absence of previous incidents. Honeywell has not assigned any cross-error to that ruling on appeal. Therefore, the law of this case is that there could be no argument or evidence regarding a purported lack of previous incidents made by Honeywell at this trial. But that's exactly the kind of argument Honeywell made in closing. Honeywell argued to the jury Why didn't they prove it? It's never happened before. There's no evidence this has ever happened anywhere, anytime. Objection was properly made that it violated the motion in limine ruling, and the court overruled that objection and said, please proceed. Honeywell then persisted in the improper line of argument, safe design for 35 years and no complaints, lack of any prior evidence of a problem. It can't do that and has never happened. Use your common sense, no evidence of a prior problem ever. Objection was renewed, and again, the trial court refused to grant any relief. Honeywell argues that this ruling is a matter for the trial court's discretion, but this case is not within the cases that where this court has held that closing argument issues are a matter of discretion. Those cases deal with the nature and extent of the relief that the trial court has to give to redress improper argument. This case, and whether the relief granted was sufficient, this case deals with a different and comes under a different line of cases, which Honeywell amazingly has ignored in their brief. This case comes under a line of cases going all the way back to Green versus Commonwealth in 1918, followed by McLean in 1947, and more recently by Reed in 1977 and Velocity Express in 2003. And those cases hold that you have an especially prejudicial situation where an objection is made to improper closing argument, and the objection is then overruled by the trial court. Because now, not only is the objecting party prejudiced by the improper argument in the first place, but it now has, as this court has said, I believe I'm using the court's exact language from Reed and Velocity Express, the improper argument now has the apparent approval of the trial court. The apparent approval of the trial court. And that's why in Reed and Velocity Express, this court has said when improper argument is made that violates the law, objection is erroneously ruled, overruled, that that's reversible error and that's prejudicial. And I want to address a few of Honeywell claims harmless error. But as I said, Velocity Express and Reed show this is not harmless error. First, the improper argument was made. Second, when it was made, the objection was overruled. Third, Honeywell repeated the improper argument. And fourth, no curative instruction was given. So there's four types of prejudice that have occurred here. Now, as the court knows, if the trial court gives a curative instruction, that's presumed to be sufficient. But as I said, here no curative instruction was given, and in fact, the objection was overruled. Now, Honeywell also argues that the error was harmless because the administrator's counsel attempted to do something in response to this shocking, explosive violation of the law of the case because he attempted to do something in rebuttal. But that's not sound, and it is not the law, I submit, of this court. First of all, the curative relief that's required has to come from the trial court, it not self-help from the opposing counsel who has already been wronged by the improper argument and then the improper overruling of it and the apparent approval that gives to the argument. The curative relief has to come from the court. When the opposing party, faced with this prejudice, attempts some rebuttal, that's not anything that comes from the court. It doesn't come with the approval of the court. And secondly, this is not a case where improper argument was invited. Sometimes this court, if there's a situation where the one party has first done something and then the other party responds with improper argument, this court has held that's not error. But here, the improper argument was not invited. Third, I respectfully submit that the law does not and should not force a litigant to choose between either doing nothing when he's been prejudiced by improper argument and an erroneous ruling, and thereby preserving the possibility of an appeal, or attempting to do something to respond and thereby forfeiting his right to an appeal. That's not consistent with the law of this court. In the context of erroneously admitted evidence, for example, this court has repeatedly held that cross-examination by the opposing party and rebuttal evidence do not waive the right to appeal. So we would submit that by analogy, by making a rebuttal argument, we have not waived our right of appeal. And I also want to touch on an important issue, because I don't want the court to believe Honeywell's implication that the rebuttal argument was false. The rebuttal argument was we did have evidence that indicated this had happened other places. Now, I want to underscore that Honeywell's
if we agree with you and reverse on that assignment of error, we never have to get to whether that argument was true or false.
No. And so if the court...
That's not relevant to your argument
today,
although I'm not disputing or agreeing with.
Right. I just wanted to note that the argument Honeywell made was so sweeping. This has never happened anywhere, any time, that the jurors could have reasonably understood it to mean that there had never been any runaway trim condition on any plane, that there had never been gears that jammed due to foreign debris that fell onto them. And we have evidence at Joint Appendix 354 to 379 and 473 to 508 that indicates that that indeed had happened.
But again, that's not relevant to this appeal.
Yes, I'm not trying to beat an issue that you're not interested in. So I will turn to decisions. This is not harmless error. The court's decisions in Goins and Wood show how prejudicial this type of thing is. Honeywell also makes an argument that there was some waiver because the request for curative instruction didn't occur until...
Mr. Kruger, you've only got about 8 minutes left. Why don't you move to the Mooney report?
Move to what?
The Mooney report.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. The Mooney report. Honeywell tries... In this case, the Mooney report was clearly hearsay. No question about it. We objected to it as hearsay. The defense contended that it fell within the authoritative treatise statute. We objected that it did not. The foundation to come within that statute had not been laid. The trial court overruled the objection, said it was a pamphlet, and allowed it into evidence. Not only allowed the expert to read from it and display it to the jury, but allowed it to be admitted into evidence as an exhibit. All of that was error. And we did preserve the hearsay objection to the exhibit being introduced in its entirety, because when the exhibit was moved into evidence, we said no objection except as previously stated. And what was previously stated and thoroughly discussed was the hearsay objection and the authority that it didn't come within the authoritative treatise statute. Now, perhaps the most glaring deficiency of this as coming within the authoritative treatise statute is that this statute requires that the treatise has to be established as a reliable authority by testimony or stipulation. And there is absolutely no testimony that was given by this expert that this was a reliable authority. He didn't even testify that he relied on it until the trial court volunteered that question, and he said, yes, I relied on it. But he did not testify, this is a published article, it's viewed in the field as a reliable authority, and he couldn't have given that testimony, because this was not a pamphlet that was published on a subject of science. It was a report, a crash report, about this particular crash by a biased company, the Mooney, the manufacturer of the airplane. Now, Honeywell argues that allowing the report into evidence and allowing it to be read from and displayed to the jury was harmless. And I've addressed that in my brief, but I want to underscore those arguments again now. It was not harmless. The Honeywell fought tooth and nail to persuade the jury that the position of the pitch on this airplane at the time of the crash was normal, was not nose down, as our case was, that the pitch, because of the jam gears, went into a nose down trim and drove the plane beyond the control of the pilot and caused it to crash. Honeywell fought tooth and nail on this issue to persuade the jury that the pitch was normal. That's why they produced evidence that they claimed showed that they had actually flown a similar plane on that pitch setting and they didn't have problems. So this was a very important issue. And this court has said that if evidence is introduced which may have tipped the balance, and if we can't say that the record clearly establishes that it could not have affected the result, then it's reversible error.
Mr. Greger, is my understanding correct that both sides agreed as to what position the jack screw was in?
Yes.
But you disputed whether that meant a normal trim or down.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And that's, Your Honor, that's another misimpression that Honeywell and I tried to create in their brief.
Excuse me. So the Mooney report, when it says in one of the paragraphs, it's on page 461 of the Joint Appendix, says this, and it's talking about the jack screw and the position, this indicates an approximate takeoff position trim setting. That is consistent with Honeywell's
yes.
position and contrary to your
yes.
position. Okay.
Yes.
I just wanted to be sure I understood the number.
Absolutely. And our experts never said that that was a normal takeoff setting. I cited and quoted the testimony in the transcript where he said, so you'll agree with me that's a normal setting? No, that's where you're wrong, counselor. That's not a normal setting. That's a nose-down setting. And it could have only gotten in that position because of runaway trim. And that's not the only place he said it was a nose-down setting. So they're wrong when they say this didn't matter because our experts agreed that that setting was a normal takeoff setting. What they agreed about, as you've correctly said, Chief Justice Kintzer, was they agreed that the position of the, they agreed on the position of the jack screw, but they vigorously disagreed about whether that meant nose down setting or normal setting. And that's why it's prejudicial error. And it's not a discretionary matter, because as this court unanimously said in Chief Justice Kintzer's opinion in Commonwealth versus Wynn, that evidence which is clearly inadmissible has to be excluded. That's not a matter for the discretion of the trial court. And she went on to say, as this court has said in other cases, that hearsay is clearly inadmissible. And this court has been very vigorous on that doctrine. Because, as this court laid out in McMunn, hearsay it violates fundamental rights in the truth-seeking process and in fundamental ingredients that are important to the truth-seeking process. The opponent can't challenge the hearsay opinion with cross-examination. The hearsay expert qualifications are never established, and the demeanor can't be observed. Now, Honeywell tries to say, well, yes, but in Bostic, we said as long as there's an expert on the stand who vouches for it, that expert can be cross-examined. But that was the particular issue in Bostic. But it doesn't mean that as long as somebody reads the hearsay to the jury and that person can be cross-examined, that the hearsay problem is cured. Obviously, somebody always reads the hearsay statement to the jury. So, Your Honors, and then also the Mooney report included the the hearsay opinion on the ultimate issue in the case as to whether the aircraft was uncontrollable. And it said there was no evidence that it was uncontrollable. Now, Honeywell says, but that wasn't read to the jury. But it went in as an exhibit. There's no way that on this record it can be plainly established that that could not have affected the jury's verdict. That's why Honeywell put it in. This is not harmless error. Now, we feel very strongly about the other assignments. In particular, on assignment 3, on the jury instruction, we believe it's critically important that the jury, in a case like this, be properly instructed on proximate cause, because in this case, it was not an either-or choice. In this case, as a matter of law, contributory negligence and assumption of the risk and misuse and superseding cause were no defense.
But, counsel, you cite the Holmes case on that point. Isn't there a distinction because of the proximate cause versus a proximate cause?
I see my time is up.
You may, may answer the question.
I would beg to answer the question.
Yeah, you may answer the question.
That is a fact that was present in Holmes that is not present here. That in Holmes, one time the jury instructions said the rather than of. But the question on if a jury instruction correctly states the law, and if it's on a point that's not fully and fairly covered by other instructions, then it's reversible error not to give it if there's any evidence to support it. So we respectfully submit that when timely request is made for this instruction, that it does fully and fairly cover this principle, and that the mere use of the word the rather than, the mere use of the word in jury instructions does not mean the multiple proximate cause issue is fully and fairly covered.
Did that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Your time has expired.
Thank you very much, Your Honors. And we rely on our briefs for all the rest of the issues.
Call the next case, please.
Sue Ann Hardy-Bryant, Patrick Rose, the athlete.